This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University agriculture professor Don Meyer says once farmers had to really strain to produce 50 bushels of corn per acre. Now, not so much.
Most farmers today are not happy with a 200 bushel corn crop. They're looking to, in the very near future, that 300 bushels will be the new norm.
200 years of agriculture, a bicentennial interview with Ryan Denham. Plus, Mary Cullen reports on the expansion of a counseling service for the uninsured and underinsured in Bloomington Normal. And the mayor of Normal stops by after the town council meeting. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal is buying two new fire engines. Joining us to talk about that, a $1.1 million decision and other municipal issues, is Mayor Chris Coos. Thanks for coming in today.
Good to be here.
Why buy two fire trucks, two at once, instead of spacing them out?
Well, Charlie, we actually had to. One was reaching the end of its useful life and had been planned to be replaced. And the second one caught on fire coming back from a run. There was a malfunction in it, and it pretty much destroyed it. And so we're getting these two fire trucks because those are what we normally run with, and we've been running with the hook and ladder, which is a much more expensive truck to run day to day. So it just made sense to do that. And the dollars came from vehicle fund reserve.
Is this going to distort the replacement schedule 20 years down the road?
Probably not. I mean, we've got plenty of time to adjust for that.
Since these weren't altogether planned for, after all, who plans for a fire engine to burn up, how is the town adjusting the budget?
Again, since we took the dollars from our vehicle fund reserve, which are dollars we put aside to buy new equipment, we'll probably have to accelerate what we put back into that fund over the next 10 years. And that's how we'll deal with it.
You didn't have all of the $1.1 million, though. Now, you did get some money from the insurance company because
right.
the one fire engine was insured, and you had some in the replacement fund. But isn't there at least some money that you'll have to find elsewhere?
Probably, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, let's get an update on the Trailside East project, a mixed-use office building slated for the traffic circle in Uptown to the north side and east of Constitution Boulevard. Earlier this year, the expectation was that the project would come back to the council in June with a little more hard detail on the design and look of it. Not only June, but July has come and gone. Mm-hmm. So what is happening?
Well, you know, Charlie, this isn't the first time this has happened in our projects. Any big project like that, our timelines tend to be best guess, and I think the biggest holdup right now is design review, working with the projected tenants on what their space needs to look like and how it functions. There's some of that. You always get the lawyers involved in redevelopment agreements, and there's tit for tat and back and forth on that. So it's probably going to be September.
Okay, so where does it stand right now, then?
It stands in design review and coming to an agreement on a redevelopment agreement.
And what is the general shape of that redevelopment agreement? Obviously, details are still in flux.
Right. I can't get into that right now.
Since a consultant presented his report on the viability of a multi-sport complex some weeks ago, all stakeholders called for a community conversation. What has happened on that?
We will have that community conversation. We're currently looking at the proposal in depth in-house. Our financial people and administrative people are looking at it and verifying whether or not they agree with the assumptions in the report. And we actually did meet with a private developer this week to have an initial conversation on a public-private partnership on this project. And it was really at a high level, get to know them, they get to know us. So no details came out of that, but they're very interested in the project.
Is that the Kim Group or the other potential developer you had referenced without serial numbers before?
It is a development group.
Okay. You said just after the meeting there is about a 90-day window to make some decisions on how to assess the $44 million project. Time is ticking. Is it going to get full consideration, or will the window expire before something can happen?
You know, I think for the town of Normal, I think we'll be in a decision mode on that in 90 to, you know, 120 days.
And how is the town making sure that Bloomington staff and Bloomington office holders are also included in that? Because it's going to need both municipalities.
On the face of it, it looks like that's what it's going to need. I think Pam has been in discussion with Tim Gleason, the new city manager, about this issue. You know. Mr. Gleason's new on the job, so, you know, he's got a whole lot of things he's looking at. But there are conversations between the two administrations.
Some office holders in Bloomington have said that they would view this as a fairly low priority on the list. Does that give the project any hope?
Well, you know, to me, it defines it. What are you defining by priority? Is it a financial priority? I think that's the intention of what their comments were. And I understand they have issues that probably do have a higher priority. That's why I've said from the beginning on this, it's going to take a robust public-private partnership to work.
So once something does get developed and the assessment is done in-house by staff, and if that assessment is a let's go ahead with something, how do you bring the public into it? What do you want the public input piece of it to
look
like?
I can't give you a detail of it, but generally what we will do is have public meetings, what we do in the town of Normal, and do presentations and have opportunity for feedback from the community. We've always done that with our projects.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. There was a glimmer of hope that downsizing a restaurant size requirement in Uptown 1, a building on the Circle, might break loose that particular deadlock. That was pulled from the council agenda a few weeks ago. Where does it stand now?
I know that Pamela Reese and the principals of Tartan Realty are going to have a meeting later this week to talk about that. The reason that was pulled back is because there was a very specific project that they had in mind for that, and we didn't particularly like it. And they decided that since that wasn't going to move forward, that they were going to pull back and leave it as is to keep their options open. Now, they may come back with yet another plan to divide that space, and we're amenable to that. It's just what it becomes once it's divided.
So what was this project that the town didn't like?
I can't say, Charlie. Sorry.
All righty. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Koos of Normal, thank you for your time.
Good to be here.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org and Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, with an established reputation in providing assisted living. Immediate availability with a simple monthly rental program. Moving assistance available by calling 309-557-8000 or visiting lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a pay-what-you-are-able counseling service expands in Bloomington Normal. Mary Cullen will have more on that. In many ways, the history of farming in Illinois is about its future, how we went from hand tools and horses to self-driving tractors and $10,000 an acre farmland. Retired Extension Director and ISU Professor Don Meyer will dive into 200 years of ag history in the Great Corn Belt later this month during a Bicentennial Speaker Series talk in Springfield. Meyer carves up Illinois farm history into four distinct areas, separated by seismic shifts in technology and world events. We're in the modern era now, he says, and GLT's Ryan Denham asked Meyer what the next era, the fifth era, might look like.
I think so, and I think, of course, technology is going to drive that. I mean, I can't envision where we're headed to. If you would have told me 20 years ago what we'd be doing with technology today, I think the fact that we have driverless cars, we already have driverless tractors. Even today, most of the time, the tractors do have farmers in them or farm help in them, but the tractors are self-guiding using satellite technologies. We're doing prescription weed control. If there's no weed, we don't need to spray. If the machine can find a weed, it can spray it. We keep track of records of where we have problems with disease, and we only need to treat those spots. We're putting our fertilizer on. We're replacing the fertilizer that the crops are using. We're putting it on where the yields are the greatest. That's where the greatest amount of fertilizer gets put back for next year's crop. So I think we're just really at the infancy stage of that. Most farmers today are not happy with a 200-bushel corn crop. They're looking to, in the very near future, that 300 bushels will be the new norm. As we did our history project, we found records of there was a 50-bushel challenge club challenging farmers to try to get 50 bushels per acre. In the 1950s, that was a 100-bushel club. And certainly now, if we had a club, it would be the 300-bushel club.
What do you think that we can learn about ourselves by looking back in this way?
I think it's a continual balancing. You know, the overall theme of 200 years, as I would say, looking back in time, is replacing labor with technology, whether that be simply hand tools with machines, whether that's being replacing labor with electricity. We've always been replacing labor. However, that's been sort of a jobs program because that labor, you know, today's tractors, the average farmer can't just tear into a tractor and overhaul it like we used to even when I was growing up. Today, everything is technology-based, and those are jobs, and those are specialized jobs. And I think the demand for the support for the farmer, we talk about the average farmer in the country. A lot of times you read the statistics that a farmer feeds himself or herself and 150 or 60 people. Really, when you look at the support network that the average farmer has to have to operate a farm, it involves a lot of people. We say typically about 20% of the jobs are somehow related to agriculture across the country. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll be the continual change. Right now, we're kind of also in the era of what I call capitalization, where it takes a lot of money to get into farming. I just couldn't quit my day job and say I'm going to go out and rent some land. First of all, the land is very competitive to even find. Most of our farmers don't own their land. They rent their land because of the cost of the land. But additionally, on top of that, the average farmer probably has between $1 and $2 million worth of equipment. So when I'm teaching students here at ISU in agriculture, you know, you think of college debt as being a burden when you graduate from college, but think about college debt plus trying to buy the equipment that you need to get into farming. That's probably the biggest challenge we have ahead of us is who can afford to get into farming with the way it's structured today. And I think a lot of folks are looking at that saying, what can be done? We don't necessarily want to go back to the old days of farming everything by hand, but that is a barrier right now to getting young people involved in farming.
My understanding is that Illinois ranks third nationally in the export of ag commodities, with about $8 billion worth of goods shipped off to other countries. In light of the recent trade disputes involving American farmers, I want to ask, when did international markets really open up to Illinois farmers for the first time? Or was it there kind of from the beginning?
I think it actually was there kind of from the beginning. Once we got the trains to arrive, we could basically take care of getting our excess commodities onto a train. And of course, we went into the trucking era. And of course, today with Illinois being, and I always try to challenge my students, you know, Illinois is a large export state because we're on a coast. And those that are busy writing down the answers don't really listen to me because we aren't on a coast. But it's because we have the Mississippi River and the Illinois River and just a tremendous amount of grain that goes down the river in barges. And we really have been a world supplier for a long time. You know, as we looked at the history, as farmers adopted seed corn from 1900 to 1930, the Funk family here in town was a big part of the seed industry. The Funks were involved in selling seed to Europe back in the early 1900s. And so we have been connected to the world for probably 100 years or more. And so that's not new. And certainly the more recent developments have impacted especially soybeans, which is one of our main lines here in Illinois.
There has been a lot of discussion right now about the Trump administration's trade policies and retaliatory actions by other countries. In the history of Illinois agriculture, though, where does this moment kind of fit in? Have there been others like it where there has been, you know, this level of uncertainty on prices, on trade involving farmers?
Yes, there have. I grew up in the 60s as a young person growing up. We had grain stored in almost every small town. In fact, the government built bins. They actually owned what we called a bin site, and there might have been 100 small bins. And the government was essentially taking the grain from the farmers because there was no market. There just wasn't an incentive to get that grain. We actually just ended up wasting some of that grain. A lot of humanitarian programs like Food for Peace, I think it's Public Law 480, came into play in that period of time in the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, and we were actually giving away the grain because it really had no value here and was going to spoil. Of course, the challenge is when you give away grain is it sometimes puts other farmers in other parts of the world out of business, and their network collapses as well. So you have to, everything, just like everything else in war and peace, you have to be delicately handling this. And right now, we're in a pivotal time with exploring what does this really mean. Most farmers would rather trade than rely on government. I know that one of the solutions right now is a government payout of some kind, but generally those aren't the long-term fix. The free trade has been really good for the farm economy overall.
What is McLean County's role in Illinois agriculture and its history? Where do we kind of fit into this world?
Well, we're, you know, early on, the soils are so good here. We are not necessarily the best soils in the state. I'm always cautious with saying that, but we probably have the largest volume of good soils of any county. It's a very large geographic, obviously the largest county in the state, still very agricultural, very productive land. That has always put us in the limelight because of just simply our sheer production numbers. But you couple that with the agribusinesses and the organizations that have centered here. We have the Illinois Farm Bureau housed right here. We have the Corn Growers, the Soybean Association, many of those organizations housed right here in Bloomington Normal. One time we had Funk Seeds, a world supplier of seed right here in Bloomington Normal. We have the insurance industry based here related to agriculture in a big way. I think it's a combination of not only the production of McLean County, but the related industries of McLean County that have really made their mark here in the county.
Well, you described the 1950s as sort of the end of the era of diversified farms.
That's right.
And if you think of farming in McLean County right now, generally you think of corn, beans, maybe some swine. Has it always been corn and beans in McLean County, or was it much more diverse prior to the 50s as it was in other places?
Well, you know, prior to the 50s, we were mostly corn. Corn has always been a mainstay from the get-go. Corn has been our main crop because we can do that more efficiently than almost anywhere else in the world. Wheat was a larger player, and oats were a larger player, as was hay. Now, when you think about the fact the 1920s tractors came into play, relying on fuel, whether that be diesel or gasoline for the tractors, prior to that time, it was oats and hay for the horses. And so it was fascinating when you look at how things may or may not have happened by design. I don't think it was by design. As the tractors arrived, we no longer needed the acreages for oats or for hay because the horse numbers declined. But at the same time, soybeans began being grown as a crop. We did not grow soybeans for their beans, at least before 1920. And it was they initially were brought in as a crop for a hay crop to feed the animals. We discovered the actual bean part of the soybean actually had more value and more potential use. And so it's fascinating when you see the substitution of oat and hay acres today at soybeans. So corn's been there all along. We've seen oats and hay diminish. We've seen soybeans pick up in a big way. And in fact, out of the last 5 years, soybeans probably have done better economically for our farms than the corn has done, which has been kind of a shock to the corn farmers. Soybeans was always that second crop we would grow just to give our soil a break from corn and to confuse the insects and the diseases a little bit. Right now we're saying, you know, as long as we get the export markets back, soybeans really are here to stay, and there could be some tremendous growth potential with soybeans.
Well, a couple of weeks ago I went out and visited the Funk family farm.
Outstanding, yeah.
The three of their their children, two of their children and one of their fiancés have started a new small local food operation, 9 acres. It's called Funk's Grove Heritage Fruits and Grains. And it's really interesting because it is based on what you're describing here, they're sort of steering back into the past a little bit.
Right.
It's 9 acres. It's very diverse, right? They've got an orchard. They've got grapevines. They're doing some corn. They're doing a lot of wheat. They're not the only ones. I mean, Epiphany Farms, Prairie Earth Farms, these sort of very diverse organic operations.
And we are seeing that. You know, we've been so heavily in what we call a commodity market, where we simply grow corn, beans, take it to the local elevator, and it becomes the property of the whole industrial processing of that crop. We are seeing an uprising of small niche markets, if you will, be they organic, be they serving a certain purpose. And I think probably part of the future will encourage more of that because some consumers would rather buy direct from a local farmer. The challenge we have, of course, is we can't grow things year-round without the advantage of having greenhouses. And so we have to relearn as a consumer that not every crop is in season every year. We've gotten to the point where I always pick on strawberries. If I want to go to find strawberries around the year, I can go to the store, and somewhere in the world they're shipping us strawberries. If we rely only on our local market, we have to learn, okay, this is the month we have strawberries. We need to better can those strawberries because they're not going to be on the shelf for the rest of the year. And I think it's kind of fascinating. I grew up doing a lot of canning with my parents, and we kind of gotten away from preservation of foods, but that may come back as a result, even changing the habits of the consumer. I know some of the folks that do subscription-based farming, where you sign up and they'll bring you, this week this crop is in season, or this week we have this vegetable that's being grown. And it's actually kind of reteaching a lot of the old ways that maybe grandma or grandpa used to do that we've kind of lost in the era of large supermarkets.
What is the face of farming these days? Who makes up the bulk of Illinois' farmers today, and how does that compare to recent eras?
I would say because of the capitalization era, we're seeing that the farmers today, the large full-time farmers, are generally farmers that have been in the business for several generations. It's been passed along, and they're able to come into the operation and use some of dad or grandpa's machinery. In some cases, we have 3 or maybe 4 generations working that farm, and that's been a kind of a trademark of Illinois farms over the years. And I think as long as the capitalization is there, we're going to continue to see that continue. Where it is family farm based, it's not corporate farming. The family may have a family corporation, but it's to protect the assets, because we know in the 1980s that was the challenge of economics, that we lost a lot of farms because of challenging economic times in the 80s.
What role have immigrants played in Illinois farming across eras?
Yes, immigration has always been a part of Illinois agriculture, central Illinois agriculture. Most of this area of the state was probably, at least in this county, I should say, would be German immigration. A lot of Irish came in because they were the cheap labor force of the time. I'm half German, half Irish, so I can pick on both of those lines of genetics, if you will. But the Germans largely were the settlers and were able to buy some land. The Irish came in and built the railroads. They helped hand dig in a lot of those drainage ditches. Many of them were paid in land because the large landowners had land more so than cash. They could just deed over some acreages. I know my great-grandfather arrived as an Irish immigrant and was a farm laborer. And by the time he retired, he owned a section of land due to the fact that he had worked hard and saved up his own money to buy that land. Those are the two dominant. We have pockets of English in the county. We also were immigrants from other parts of the U.S. We had the Yankees, we call them, that arrived from the East Coast and were unhappy that things were changing on the coast. This was considered the promised land to move west and do well. And so we have what Greg Coos at the museum calls the Yankees from the East Coast. We have upland Southerners who came up from Kentucky and Tennessee. A lot of those folks came here because there were jobs on the farm. They had to help with harvest, and once they got here, they stayed and worked their way into a farm. So not all of our immigration was across the ocean per se, but it was as much in within the U.S. Watching the immigration patterns as well.
So Don, you'll be speaking in Springfield at the as part of the Bicentennial Speaker Series. You'll be speaking Sunday, August 19th at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. What do you hope that people take away from your remarks?
Well, I think generally I've done a lot of local programs, and this will be a little larger territory to cover. They're going to learn a lot about Central Illinois. I'm not sure I can speak for Northern or Southern Illinois as well as I can Central Illinois. But I think the dialogue, and my hope would be that as I've seen audiences, I see the intergenerational connect, where if it's a grandparent talking to a grandchild or a grandchild saying, now I know what my grandfather or grandmother was talking about, I think it's one of those puzzle pieces as you're trying to sort out, either as an older person where what your roots are based upon, or as a younger person, how did this all happen? Hopefully kind of explain the why behind where we are today. I think sometimes we just assume, well, here we are, it's always been this way, it's always been this easy, or this good, or this big. No, and I think we have to understand that, and of course many of us as young people dreaded history classes, but I think having lived it now, it becomes more interesting to be able to pass that along. And one of the things I really enjoyed seeing is the intergenerational discussions where, you know, grandparents will bring someone through the museum display and I'll listen across the room and hear them tell their own story, because certainly the story we've told through our exhibit is simply what we could best assemble with information we could find. But there are lots of stories that have yet to be told publicly that within families need to be shared.
That's Don Meyer, a staple in McLean County Agriculture, a former extension director, now teaching at Illinois State University. We'll talk about the history of farming in the Great Corn Belt during a bicentennial speaker series talk Sunday, August 19th, at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. It's also the last day for the Illinois State Fair. I'm Ryan Denham.
And this is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
What looks like journalism these days sometimes isn't. At GLT, we answer to listeners, not advertisers or corporations. Listeners help pay for news and the reporters who cover the facts. Eric Stock, a 27-year news veteran covering Bloomington Normal.
Contributor to the recent spike in gun violence.
Mary Cullen, her last beat, the State House.
Frontier Airlines is coming back to Central Illinois. Regional
Independent,
Airport.
Financially supported by listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Rhonda Glenn Law Offices. With offices in McLean and Livingston counties, they've served clients throughout Illinois for 30 years with quality legal services and family law, including adoption and dissolution of marriage. Information at glennlawoffices.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up on Sound Ideas, murder and politics, not so distant and pursuits. We hear from IPR. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Bloomington counseling center that provides service for the poor and uninsured has new space with room for additional counseling opportunities. Integrity Counseling operates largely with volunteers and with a pay-what-you-are-able philosophy. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Integrity co-founders Luella and Don Mahana about the new location.
Integrity Counseling recently moved two doors down from their previous location. Don Mahana says this move gives them more space to make a difference in the community.
We're calling this moving two doors down to double our space and double our impact. In our previous space, we were starting to get a little confined in terms of what we could do from room to room. And this space gives us the opportunity to have six rooms dedicated to counseling, and to have space where we could do client mentoring and even looking at things like art therapy. So it gives us the opportunity to do a lot more than our original mission of just doing counseling.
And with this move, have you gained any spaces that you weren't able to have before? I know we did a walkthrough before we started this interview, and you pointed out the possibility for having like a water arts section. Is there anything else like that you didn't have before that now you can expand on?
Well, we have a dedicated room now that has the ability to be both a counseling for adults and counseling for children. So having a space that allows us to do that is very, very nice to have. And with 16 active counseling volunteers at the end of August, we needed a space where counselors could get together to work together. And we now have a break area where that allows that to happen. So it'll allow the counselors to work together on self-development and on client issues.
We're actually sitting here in my favorite space, which is a group room. In the space that we had before, we didn't have any place that we could really do family counseling or have groups other than our front lobby. And if we were to use it that way, we'd have to do it after hours. But now we can run groups during the daytime, and we've already had some family sessions in this room.
So expanding on that group session, I know we're sitting in this room right now. We're seeing there's four chairs, there's a couch, it's cozy, it's very warm feeling. What's the benefit of having the space and being able to conduct a group therapy session?
There's a lot of benefits that come out of group therapy. It's certainly a different dynamic than when you meet one-on-one with somebody. When you have group therapy, you get to, first of all, you build your support system. People usually at least connect with people, you know, while they're at group. They have people that have similar concerns. And find out that they're not the only ones that have those concerns. And so really, I love the idea of being able to run groups because it just, you're also able to see more people at one time. So it just has so many benefits to doing it versus just having the ability to do individual counseling.
When it comes to group sessions compared to individual sessions, what's the rate of people that you see coming in?
We actually have just started having family sessions. We haven't planned a group yet. It's kind of, you know, since we've just been in this space 2 weeks, we've been, a lot of that time has been actually unpacking and putting things away. So, but we do plan. We have a meeting next week with a couple of our people that want to work on groups, and we're hoping to have some up and running by September.
Well, one of the other things for the move was in doubling our impact. In 2017, we did about 1,500 appointments. And so our goal is by the end of 2019 to raise that number to 3,000. And so groups will help us to have more client service hours, and the opportunities that we have here to add program will give us more opportunities to do more service to more people.
Can you explain maybe the history of Integrity, when you started, just kind of what that experience was like?
Well, Integrity was started actually as a response to what we were seeing in the mental health issues around the county jail. And Luella and I talked about, well, what can we do to make a difference? And we thought that trying to have a significant access to mental health services for people who were uninsured or underinsured would make a difference in stopping the slide towards the jail, and also just giving that ability to stabilize families and individuals who were having difficulty. And so what we did is that we found a space here in the old St. Joseph's Hospital Annex. This building is actually owned by Scott Preston, who is a Normal Town Councilman. And we found a space here, and we took a leap to try to figure out how to do this and make it make sense. And we started with just Luella. And she had the background of counseling the mentally ill in the homeless situations and had that experience in previous opportunities. And so we just took a leap to try to do it, and here we are 4 years later, and we're going to double our space, and we have 16 active counselors here by the end of August.
You also mentioned to me earlier on our tour that you have quite a few volunteers. How does the volunteer process work here, and what do these volunteers do?
Well, the main thing that our volunteers do for us right now is the front desk. We have to have reception and people who greet people. And one of the things that we try to do is we offer a bottle of cold water to anyone who comes in the door, because we want this to be a welcoming place. And so our front desk people are the face to the public and show people that first care as they come in the door. So we also have people who help us do things like marketing and brochures and help us prepare materials for distribution. So there are a lot of different ways in which people can bring the skills that they have or their own passions into Integrity to help us.
So you mentioned handing out those bottled waters, making sure that it's a welcoming space. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that to me when I first walked in the door. You offered me a bottle of water. You offered me a cookie if I wanted one. What else about this space is focused on making sure that it's comforting?
Well, I think the rooms themselves are laid out kind of like a family room, trying to be not clinical but comfortable. And because when people can come and experience a bit of comfort that's physical, then they can relax and be able to talk about their issues.
Your website mentioned that there are limited mental health options in McLean County, and Integrity is there to fill in those gaps. Could you expand on that?
Well, the state has, as we all know, has been kind of in a crisis for many years. So we know that some of the local state-funded centers are really only able to now take on the very hardest cases, the ones that, you know, people are either homicidal or suicidal or just very chronic. You know, they would like to be able to see more people themselves, but unfortunately they are just limited in their availability to see clients. So we are actually able to fill that gap because we are completely a donation-based center. So Center of Human Services has referred to us because they know that we're here and that we can see clients, you know, get them in sooner.
We receive no direct funding from any government agency today, and we also do not accept insurance. So as a result, we have a very simple business process that allows us to move in a way that allows us to go quickly, and to with a dozen different people that we have access to, we can contact from our network and try to get people in. So often we can move pretty quickly to get people in to get some help. We do ask our clients to contribute what they can. We'll never turn anyone away for a financial reason. And some people are very proud to give us a dollar every third session. And some people write us a very nice check for what they would have spent in a deductible or another arrangement, or because they think it's the right thing for them to do. So our clients actually today provide about half of our operating cost, and the rest of it comes from donations from individuals, groups, churches, and clubs.
How would you say this new facility is going to positively impact your clients?
I can tell you that the clients that we've already had, that we had before we moved in here, they walk in and they're kind of just looking around and saying, This place looks so nice inside, and we can really tell that they feel like they're in a warm and caring environment. I think our new clients as well are coming in and saying, this is a nice place, and they feel very welcomed here. So I think that, as much as anything, we're reaching our goal doing that.
I think another aspect of the space is that it presents a very professional but warm feeling, and I think that builds confidence for the people who come here, that they know they're going to get help because they walk in and see, oh, they have their act together and they have a beautiful space. And that gives them confidence, I think, that they'll be able to be helped here.
Could you walk me through the different services that are provided? I know counseling is kind of, you know, an umbrella term, and there's so many different things that go into it. Could you possibly talk about what exactly you guys do here?
Sure. Well, we do a lot of individual counseling. We see adults, children, adolescents. We do some family counseling, and we're actually added a lot of couples counseling sessions in the last year. A couple of our counselors that we've gained in the last year that's really what they love to do, is they love to work with couples. So we really feel blessed to have, you know, the people that are willing to see couples and are experts at it. You know, not all of us are experts at the same thing, so it's nice to have that variety of options based on what our counselors like to do.
So you showed me when we were on our tour, there was a room with a bunch of games in it, and actually it looked like a lot of fun. Can you talk about how games can be used in the counseling setting?
We call that room our MVP room. A lot of times when a child comes to counseling, they're scared. Their mom or dad is saying, you know, you need counseling. And children are often scared. You know, they have to talk to a stranger, and how are they supposed to, you know, open up? And so having a game that you can play with a child during the session is a really good way to build rapport. Usually what happens is counselors can kind of check in about their issues while they're playing the game, and can actually, you know, provide some coping mechanisms at the same time. So it's really a cool thing for kids to have.
So you mentioned earlier you had a goal of increasing your clients from 1,500 to 3,000. How else are you looking further down the line and creating goals for this facility?
Well, what we've actually done is we put together a vision team who has had several meetings, and we're working our way towards having a set of specific goals and actions for the next couple of years. We are planning to sit down with each of our counselors in a session and talk about what they see as our opportunities and our ability to reach out. We're talking to our clients, and we're also interested in gaining from the community. And as I mentioned earlier, we're trying to make sure that we align with the mental health action plan of the county so that we can support that as well. So we're really excited about the opportunity to set some specific goals. We know one of the things that we have is the ability to, with the resources that we have, ability to do workshops. And we have clients or counselors who have those skills, and we want to be able to reach out into the community, do more education. We think that reducing stigma, which is a NAMI goal, is also a huge goal for us, and we want to align with NAMI as we go about trying to reduce stigma surrounding mental illness. We think that education and awareness makes it more easy for people to reach out for help, and so we want to continue to do that. We're reaching out directly to do partnerships with other organizations. We are just entering into an agreement with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Bloomington Normal to provide counseling to their clients as a cooperation between agencies. And so we're looking for those opportunities where Integrity can reach out and work with other agencies to reach the right population to help across the community.
When it comes to Integrity, you guys have capitalized the I, the N, and then the R and the I. Could somebody please explain to me?
Well, the logo actually has a number of layers to it. And the logo was designed for us by Madonna Courtright, who is with the Humane Society, but also a dear friend of ours. And the logo incorporates our fathers and our faith. And the ichthys, the fish, the coil, that's actually an ichthys, which was drawn by my father in the 1980s before he passed away. And then Do Be Healed is actually Luella's dad's initials, which puts both of our fathers in the middle of it. Integrity is a word that means a lot to us. And then the capitalization of the letters is actually the letters for INRI, which is what's above the cross in the crucifixion. So it reflects our fathers, our faith, and our passion for doing things right.
Don and Luella Mahana of Integrity Counseling, their co-founders, speaking with GLT's Mary Cullen. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, diving into a state fair tradition. It's not often politics and murder get mixed together outside of fiction, but IPR Illinois politics reporters Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney have a story about a Southwest suburban man charged with murdering his longtime friend, about how his arrest affected a race in this year's high-stakes election, and how it relates to one of the most powerful politicians in Illinois. Tony Arnold starts us off.
Elise Hoffenberg is a school board member for District 105 in Southwest Suburban LaGrange, and she was inspired by Bernie Sanders to do something no Democrat had done in 8 years, challenge the most powerful Republican in the Illinois House of Representatives.
I heard the call Bernie sent out after Donald Trump was elected. You know, if you really want to change the landscape of politics, run for office. You know, Samantha Bee put the call out. I was like, heck. Here I am, I'm a mom, I'm committed to my community, and, you know, why don't I run?
As she started to put her campaign for state representative together last year, Hoffenberg says she met some colorful characters who were part of the political scene. Some of them have since been fired from Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan's political organization after being publicly accused of bullying and sexual harassment. And another, Hoffenberg says, would end up dooming her candidacy altogether. That was Michael Pelko, a trader who worked in downtown Chicago. He showed up to a campaign event and told Hoffenberg he lived nearby and he was a Little League coach. And she says he promised her big things.
I can do these amazing things for you. I'm going to, you know, you're going to be a star and I'm going to make you a star. Kind of things of that nature and in that vein.
Hoffenberg says she didn't really believe him, but she was polite and she says it was actually the first and last time she saw him. But Hoffenberg says come December, Pelko did end up doing one thing that was meant to benefit her campaign. In Illinois, every candidate has to turn in signatures to get on the ballot. And Pelko challenged the legitimacy of the petitions of her Democratic primary opponent to try to kick him off the ballot. Hoffenberg says she didn't know Pelko was doing this, and she was even more surprised in January when she opened up the newspaper and saw his face. Pelko had been charged with murdering his longtime friend, accused of shooting him twice in the head and then leaving the body in a Chicago alley.
You know, I have three young children. You know, I really don't live that far from him. So the whole thing just made me feel uncomfortable and unsafe, to be honest with you.
So here's Hoffenberg, who was new to this realm of politics. She's meeting some people she didn't particularly like being around, and the name of a man charged with murder had been on an election form meant to help her.
It really felt like I was riding a roller coaster with a blindfold on. I didn't know what was around the next bend. I knew whatever was going to happen would be unexpected, and it wasn't a comfortable place for me.
A short time later, Hoffenberg dropped out of the race.
I'm Dave McKinney. Michael Pelko had not been overly active in politics before he filed his petition challenge against Hoffenberg's Democratic primary opponent. And challenging a candidate's petitions is a sophisticated legal process. The names on Hoffenberg's campaign forms and around Pelko's signature were some of the biggest names in House Speaker Michael Madigan's powerful political operation. Two were the people fired for allegedly bullying or sexually harassing colleagues. So you may be wondering how Pelko's name got on this election form in the first place. Well, Stephen Landeck has an answer. Landeck is a Democratic state senator from Bridgeview, and he says Elise Hoffenberg was an ideal candidate. Landeck says the Democratic Party of Illinois wanted to help her out, and Landeck knew of Pelko from some of his work around the community.
He looked like a credible, honest person, and given his background, as he seemed to have a business and he had some employees. That's what it was portrayed to us. We don't check everybody.
Landeck says he has no clue about Pelko's arrest. He referred Pelko's name to the Democratic Party of Illinois as a guy from the district who could be listed on a form to try to kick Hoffenberg's opponent off the ballot. Michael Casper is one of the few attorneys in Chicago to practice election law. He is the attorney for the Illinois Democratic Party, which is chaired by House Speaker Michael Madigan. Casper represents up to 75 candidates in any given election cycle, and in this case, he represented Michael Pelko's petition challenge.
I don't recall how he got my name or who referred him to me.
Casper says he didn't know Pelko and didn't know about Pelko's murder charge until we told him. A spokesman for Madigan says the speaker didn't know Pelko either, and that Pelko was never involved in Madigan's political organization or the Democratic Party of Illinois. But Michael Dorf says they should have checked Pelko out. Dorf is another election law attorney. He represented Barack Obama years ago, and he frequently goes up against Casper, including on this case. Dorf represents Elise Hoffenberg's opponent, Tom Klistic, which means Dorf was defending the signatures Pelko and Casper were challenging. Dorf says Pelko's name in an election form like this is another embarrassment for the political organization of Speaker Madigan, already under fire for bullying and sexual harassment.
This is the drip, drip, drip that is just wearing away the stone. I can't believe that if they were paying attention that they would have allowed something like this to happen.
Again, here's Michael Casper, the attorney for the Democratic Party of Illinois.
To the extent that Mr. Dorf is saying that this was sanctioned by Speaker Madigan or anyone else at the Democratic Party, I don't have any reason to believe that that's accurate.
Michael Pelko has pleaded not guilty to murder charges. He's in Cook County Jail awaiting trial. And Pelko also has another criminal case pending for allegedly stealing from a Menards store and then hitting a security guard with his car in the parking lot. And Elise Hoffenberg, who dropped out of the race, said as she looks back on her experience running for office, she realizes now she had on rose-colored glasses.
It went south. Everything went south. Handful of people who I encountered during this process, you know, ended up having all kinds of negative things. And I'm sort of happy to be back in my life where, you know, the worst thing that happens is our toilet gets clogged up or our backyard floods.
Hoffenberg says she put herself out there by getting involved in Illinois politics. She says she was naive. I'm Tony Arnold.
And I'm Dave McKinney.
And this is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An Iowa artist is busy this summer creating special sculptures for the Illinois and Iowa State Fairs. Michelle O'Neill of IPR reports Sarah Pratt has been sculpting the butter cow for the Iowa State Fair since 2006.
Sarah Pratt says 2018 is the 100th anniversary of Deere & Company's Waterloo Boy Tractor. and the Iowa State Fair asked Pratt to recreate it in butter.
The wheels are so open and exposed with the spokes and the gears, and I really want that to shine through and not to get bulky and clunky with a lot of structure. So that's been a challenge, to design something that will hold up all the butter weight without getting in the way of the butter.
As a 14-year-old 4-H'er, Pratt learned how to sculpt in butter from the Butter Cow Lady herself, Iowa's Norma Lyon, also known as Duffy. Pratt took over 12 years ago when Lyon retired. This year, the Illinois State Fair asked Pratt to create something unique for the state's bicentennial, but she can't reveal what it is before the unveiling at the fairgrounds in Springfield.
The challenge is, after a tradition has been like the state of Illinois for 200 years, and the tradition of having butter sculptures in Illinois for over 90 years now, a lot of ideas have been done. So it's that mix between what's fresh and what's traditional.
Butter sculpting is a family affair at the Pratt household. Her dad, brother, and husband help her by welding the frame together. Environmentalists and sanitarians will be happy to know the butter is recycled.
Each fair has their own stock of butter that's been donated by a local dairy producer. And the cooler gets warmed up just a little bit, softens it, and then it gets scraped down, packed into the buckets really firm, so to leave out any air and moisture. And then it gets frozen until the next fair, and it starts all over again.
The Iowa State Fair worked with Deere & Company, which sent Pratt photographs of the 1918 Waterloo Boy. She also visited the John Deere Tractor and Engine Museum in Waterloo to study one of the iconic tractors in person. At the Iowa State Fair beginning August 9th, Pratt will answer questions and put the finishing touches on her butter sculptures, but she'll complete her works of art for the Illinois State Fair before opening day, also August 9th. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.